May it please the court, Fred Cottrell from Richards, Leighton & Finger for Appalee Advanced Micro Devices. With me at council table from the Fulbright and Jaworski firm, Stephen Dillard and Marcy Greer. And with the court's permission, Mr. Dillard will make argument for AMD.
Welcome to the court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Richard Gebelein on behalf of the appellants. I would like to introduce to the court Stephen Phillips and Victoria Phillips of the firm of Phillips and Pellicelli, who have been admitted pro hac. Mr. Stephen Phillips will be presenting argument for the appellants.
Welcome to the court.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Please.
Your Honor, with the court's permission, I should like to reserve 5 minutes of time. May it please the court, the Daubert motion that really is at the center of this appeal was by stipulation, by court order, and I think by operation of law to be decided pursuant to Delaware's evidentiary rules and the Daubert jurisprudence of Delaware. And as I think Your Honors can see from the court below's decision, that did not occur. What transpired instead was that the court applied Texas law and erred, we believe, in many respects. Before addressing the legal standards, I'd like to acquaint the court and give the court a flavor for the, I would suggest, extraordinary amount of proof that was offered by the plaintiffs, and to make before that the observation that rather extraordinarily, the defendants offered no proof at all, so that the record was by design completely one-sided in that the plaintiffs presented both live testimony and by affidavit the testimony or the proof from many experts, and the defendants relied entirely on legal argument and relied entirely upon credibility questions, which I think conflated the question of a summary judgment motion with what a Daubert motion properly should be.
Well, just to pause on that, there was the record before us was at the trial level a combination of live testimony and a paper record?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what was the nature of the Daubert motion? Was it findings of fact after trial? Was it summary judgment or none of the above?
Neither. And that is very much of the essence. The defendants, and this, again, was quite unusual, in the midst of a scheduling order that would have proceeded in orderly fashion to the usual situation where a Daubert motion is presented at the close of all discovery and followed shortly thereafter or simultaneously with a summary judgment motion saying, if the proof fails, there's summary judgment. Here, and the record's very clear about this, the defendants boldly asked in the middle for a Daubert hearing only. No summary judgment motion. There's discovery that was yet unconcluded. The plaintiffs assented to a Daubert motion only, which was an in limine motion respecting the evidentiary admission at trial to occur down the road. Summary judgment motions did not occur and were not to occur until much later.
Well, let me pursue this for a minute. Is it your position that in this particular context, the Daubert motion, or to put it differently, the way the court should have proceeded on the Daubert motion would be akin to a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6? I mean, what animal here are we dealing with?
No, quite to the contrary, and that's very much a part of what I think led the court below into error. This was not a 12b-6 motion. It was not a summary judgment motion.
And it wasn't a trial.
It was not a trial. This was an in limine hearing of an evidentiary nature only, designed, Justice Jacob, purely for the purpose of determining whether or not, under the Daubert jurisprudence of Delaware, these witnesses, or particularly the one particular witness who testified, had sufficient reliability and relevance under your Daubert jurisprudence to testify. And the record that we presented, I would suggest, would satisfy any standard that one could possibly imagine with respect to the admissibility of proof. At the end of the day, it would be available to the defendant at some later point in this procedural posture. It would have been perfectly permissible for a defendant to later say, okay, this evidence has been admitted, but it's not sufficient.
Well, Daubert contemplates a gatekeeping function, and that necessarily means sometimes the gate is open and sometimes the gate is closed.
Justice Ridgely, precisely so. And the point then becomes a focused consideration of what that gatekeeping function is.
And what was the specific error in exercising that function that was made here?
Oh, Your Honors, there were many. Let me begin by saying that the court, first of all, completely conflated legal sufficiency with the gatekeeping standard, which is relevance and reliability, and therefore committed a legal error. Secondly, in the brief, we set forth with specificity 15 different instances, which are but 15 of many, where the court simply, in rendering its ruling, ignored the record or misapprehended the record. For instance, just to give an illustration, the court chose to ignore an epidemiologic study that was perfectly on point, involving the same injury, the same exposure, the same gender of the parent. Everything fit perfectly. This is the Lynn study that we talk about at great length in the brief, and just chose not to credit that there was what in the scientific and Daubert term was fit. Just said that he didn't agree with the only competent witness who was in front of him, who told him that there was fit. The judge found that there was no comparison between the exposures that these parents experienced and the exposures in the studies. He was simply mistaken, Your Honor, as we demonstrate. So that was a second variety of error. A third variety of error is that the court seized upon Texas law. If you read the court's decision, I'm sure you have, but the court never says that Dr. Frazier, who incidentally he admired and said was a credible, he spoke praisefully of the witness, so that he wasn't troubled by her qualifications, by the depth of the research. He said that Texas imposes a standard in its substantive law, and that standard requires a certain proof with epidemiologic studies. There are two problems.
Well, before we get into that, let me just ask you two questions that follow up on Justice Ridgely's. The first one, you can answer with one word. The second might take a paragraph.
I'll try my best.
The first question is, does it matter to your position whether this motion is decided under Texas law or under Delaware law? Is that a pivotal issue?
The answer to that is no, and I would need to explain why. The laws
are... You pass even under Texas law, is what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Okay. The one of the problems that I personally have with the briefing is that although there are, as you said, numerous claims of error, the only coherent opinion that we have on the subject is the trial court's. But what I don't see is, this is obviously counterfactual, a model opinion that would go the other way. If you were writing in a paragraph an opinion that would go the way that your client argues that it should, what would it read like?
Your Honor, it would read as follows. It says, this case arises under Delaware law. In Delaware, the Daubert standard, as enunciated by the Supreme Court and by numerous superior courts.
Okay, but on this case, moving from the global.
After that prefatory standard, say, in this case, Dr. Frazier and her colleagues met every Daubert standard, as well as the Texas dicta, if that is relevant at all. She has provided thorough research, has provided ample methodological bases. Incidentally, the trial court didn't deny any of this. She has presented the court with animal studies involving these chemicals. She has identified the chemicals. She has quantified or provided proof quantifying the exposures. She has cross-referenced those with the studies to show that the exposure was adequate. She has identified the injuries. She has used the methodology of differential diagnosis and etiology to rule out alternative causes. She has looked at this from a chemical perspective, from an industry perspective, and therefore, by any measure, this testimony should be presented to the jury. It will be helpful in assisting them in deciding this case. And the defendant's criticisms of Dr. Frazier are properly presented to the jury because it's well established that even if this were shaky testimony, which I would suggest it is not, it is for the fact finder to determine, and the defendant's task would be to cross-examine and to challenge the testimony at trial. The other thing that would be in what I fear is a lengthy paragraph, but you'll forgive me, Your Honor, is the fact that this is a procedurally extraordinary setting in which the defendants came forward with no proof from any expert to challenge the plaintiff's expert's proofs, and this court should not and cannot make credibility determinations to strike a qualified expert who comes forward and presents the court with a coherent and well-reasoned presentation that meets the Daubert criteria, the Bradford Hill criteria.
Mr. Phillips, did the court make a credibility determination in the sense of believability? Is that in the opinion?
Your Honor, in so many words, yes, without characterizing it as such. But for instance, as we point out in our brief, time and again, Judge Silverman asserts that he does not credit Dr. Frazier. I mean, for instance, a critical question when we get to epidemiology is does the study fit? Is it a proper study? All of plaintiff's experts, two of whom were highly credentialed epidemiologists, say again and again, these studies fit. They are proper studies. They're studies of the proper chemical. They're study of the proper industry. They're proper studies, and they fit. If you read just Judge Silverman's decision, he goes a great length to say, well, I don't accept that. I don't accept that these studies fit because I'm going to accept the defense argument that, well, this study involved a chemical that may be similar or might not be similar. this study arose in Taiwan at a fabricating plant, and maybe Taiwan is different than Texas. And what he's doing is inverting, he's making credibility determinations on a record which I don't think a judge could be permitted to make credibility determinations. And there's even a constitutional dimension to this because we're entitled to a jury trial.
I think credibility, I think, is the word that confuses here, because what you call credibility could be argued equally as being the rejection of inferences. That is, the inferences that Fraser drew, which of course is closer to gatekeeping than determining who's believable.
Well, your Honor, you have, I want to preserve my times, but let me respond very quickly by saying that this went way over the line, because what happened here, with all respect, is you had an uncontradicted record. You have a judge who admires the witness and who then, on his own initiative, was not drawing inferences. He was simply making factual conclusions that this was a record that he just wasn't going to, to put it bluntly, believe or accept the testimony of the doctor. And there he was substituting his own judgment for a role that really belongs with a jury. It's not for a judge in a Daubert thing, let alone in a summary judgment consequence thing, to do that. Your Honor, thank you for your patience, and I'll look forward to speaking after my colleague talks.
Good morning again, Your Honors. Stephen Dillard on behalf of AMD. I want to respond first to counsel's comments that the trial judge here weighed the credibility of the witness. I submit that he did no such thing. What he did is he weighed the credibility of the evidentiary support that the witness was relying upon for the opinions that she was expressing that were being challenged by us. The second thing, before I get into, if I could, an overview of some of the basic facts, is the trial court spent 4 days listening to Dr. Fraser testify. Now, we just heard counsel say that he admired her and respected her and commented favorably on her credentials, all of which are true. But that's not what was at issue, because as we know, a Daubert issue is not necessarily about the resume and the qualifications and the credentials of the expert. It's about relevance and reliability, the twin prongs of Daubert, and I want to talk more about that, if I could, in just a moment. Your Honors, when you boil it all down, what this case really represents are Texas residents who are attempting to flee the law of their home state to come to Delaware to try out clearly a new and untested tort, birth defects in the offspring of workers in the semiconductor industry. And it's important to note,
before you go on, I want to pause, because I think it's an important issue for us to decide, is whether the result, in your view, in your client's view, the result would be different if the case were decided purely under Delaware Daubert law as distinguished from Texas law.
Your Honor, I believe we'd reach the same outcome either way, and I'll tell the court why. Of course, Judge Silverman applied the applicable Texas substantive law, and as you've seen in his opinion, he explains why the evidentiary support for it did not meet the Texas standard, did not satisfy. But if you divorced it from the applicable Texas substantive law and just focused on Delaware Daubert law, which is what the court's asking, this witness did not cite a single Kemp, contrary to what, and I understand the court's dilemma here with a he said, she said situation, but I just go back to the court's order. Not a single chemical specific to the alleged outcome here, the health outcomes, the birth defects here. Not a single study showing these particular birth defects. No dose response. Another counsel mentioned the Bradford Hill criteria. No dose response. No definition or description of the so-called dose response curve. It fails to meet the specificity requirements, the dose response requirements that are classic Daubert principles independently of application of Texas substantive law.
Plaintiff's counsel's brief points out that as far as the chemicals are concerned, there's one of the studies does line up with one of the chemicals that at least one of the plaintiffs was exposed to, and that's ethylene glycol. Moreover, one of the injuries, that is heart problems, cardiac problems, I believe, also line up with the injuries that were involved in one of the studies that were relied on. So there wasn't a complete disconnect between the facts of the case at issue here and the studies.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, I think that there was a complete disconnect. And I say that for several reasons. First, with respect to the chemicals, and counsel has told the court that the chemicals were identified. The chemicals, in fact, were not identified. Dr. Frazier, when she gave her deposition, refused to be pinned down on what the chemicals were at issue. When she came to the Daubert hearing...
Well, she refused to be pinned down in the sense that she identified some but said there may be others, as opposed to saying I can't identify any.
She did say there may be others, but she said it could be some subset of these on this list of 10 that she came to the hearing with on index cards. It could be some subset of these, could be all of them, could be some of them, probably a mixture, could be chemicals that are not on the list. And here we are talking about an immature tort, a new and untested tort, and I believe and we believe it is incumbent upon the expert to say, if A causes B, what is A? What is A? And show me a study where it's caused B. And she acknowledged that there's no chemical that's used at AMD that has been associated, for example, with Vodder Association, one of the two offspring, the birth defects of one of the two offspring. And when you look at the Lynn study, which I think is perhaps the one that the court was, certainly counsel mentioned, there is no information whatsoever about exposure levels in that study. So how much exposure does it take? And these are the types of things that certainly the Supreme Court of Texas has said you must have to establish, satisfy causation in a case like this. And we submit it is critically important in the immature tort situation. This is not mesothelioma and asbestos. This is a new tort.
I'm not sure I understand new tort. Thought it was the same tort, just different fact.
Well, Your Honor,
pattern.
New in this sense, that to our knowledge, the medical and scientific communities have not accepted the proposition that's being offered. Nor, to our knowledge, has any court of law accepted this. So it is a new tort in that sense. It is certainly an immature tort.
Now, Mr. Phillips has argued that the trial judge conflated summary judgment with Daubert. Why is he incorrect?
He's wrong, Your Honor, because this was a classic situation for the Daubert gatekeeper. We chose to challenge this expert's opinions on causation and the scientific basis for them. Causation is a linchpin without which the case cannot go forward. Otherwise, we would not be here because the causation testimony was excluded. And that would be true, I might add, under any law that we want to apply in an alleged toxic exposure case without evidence of causation. This was ripe for the Daubert gate. There are other, the counsel seemed to suggest that we need to go all the way through discovery and through maybe a motion for summary judgment practice first. I know of no reason, we know of no reason why that is so. And as a matter of fact, many of the Daubert opinions, and I've tried to read all of them, I won't say I've read them all from Delaware, catch this issue at the Daubert gate before it gets through extraordinarily expensive discovery for another year or two. If the experts' opinions are not going to be supported by sufficient science, reliable science, and are therefore not relevant, there is no reason that that cannot be addressed at the stage of the proceeding where it was addressed here.
Mr. Dillard, you know, unfortunately, some of us judges, or at least I, happen to think in procedurally in categorical terms, and I'm not sure, you know, how to conceptualize this type of Daubert motion. That is, what, you know, if it were a Daubert motion analogized to Rule 12b-6, I would understand that, because that standard is well set out. Similarly for summary judgments, similarly for, you know, fact-finding after trial. But apparently the Daubert motion in this case was none of the above, or is it? That is, what is it, what operation is the court supposed to go through mentally in evaluating the motion before it?
Well, Your Honor, the order in which it went, in which it proceeded, there was the Daubert motion, the disqualification of the opinions on causation, which set up a summary judgment motion, since the case cannot then go forward under any state's law in a toxic exposure, an alleged toxic exposure case.
Are you saying that the predicate motion that the judge had to decide was a disqualification motion, which was a summary judgment motion?
No, Your Honor, the predicate motion that the court decided was, can this witness and their entire causation case pass through the Daubert gate?
Okay, and in deciding that, does the court use a 12b-6 standard, a Rule 56 standard, or some other standard?
Well, I think the standard that he used was a Daubert standard.
It was
a Daubert hearing, a Daubert transcript, and he said this case in his order, he says this case is what Daubert is about.
Well, that may be, but I'm not sure what Daubert is about in terms of what the procedural operation that the court's analysis has to undergo, and that's what I'm asking you.
Well, I don't think it was obviously it was not a summary judgment motion up first, and it was not a Rule 12 motion up first. It was a Daubert motion. The causation testimony is excluded, and then summary judgment is based upon that.
Mr. Dillard, is it fair to say that characterizing it as a Daubert motion is another way of saying, on a precise question of the qualifications or the admissibility of the opinion of an expert witness, where the case cannot go forward without expert testimony, it's the equivalent of a motion in limine to prevent evidence from being admitted that should not be admitted? And in effect, what it amounts to is an economizing way of dealing with the linchpin issue before the parties engage in discovery that ultimately would be useless. And you, as soon as you can zero in on sufficient evidence to address the sufficiency and admissibility of an expert opinion, you do so. It's procedural economy. No matter how you want to try to pigeonhole it into some other mechanism. Is that fair?
It is. The Chief Justice has expressed it better than I, obviously, but that's exactly what happened.
Well, let me turn for a minute to where I'm having difficulty, and that's this concept of there is an issue of admissibility and there's an issue of sufficiency, and does Delaware law touch to more than one of those, or does Delaware law touch to the first and Texas law to the second, admissibility being first, sufficiency being second. The trial judge said, and I think this is an accurate quote, an opinion that is deemed reliable under Delaware law is irrelevant if that opinion would not be given any evidentiary value because it is deemed unreliable under Texas law. Now, that seems to me admissibility is relevancy, sufficiency is reliability. But can you explain what he meant by that?
Yes, Your Honor, what he meant by that, and of course we recognize that Delaware law governs the admissibility of evidence in this state. And in the context that we're here about today and the basis of it for these motions, since 1999, that has meant Daubert. And Daubert, of course, sets up the twin prongs of relevance and reliability. and it is incumbent, as we know, upon the sponsoring party, in this case the plaintiffs, to prove to the satisfaction of the gatekeeper by preponderance of the evidence that the expert's testimony is and opinions are based upon relevant and reliable evidence. And here, Judge Silverman correctly determined, applying applicable Texas substantive law, and make no mistake, it is substantive law. I must disagree with my friend, Mr. Phillips. It is, and the Texas Supreme Court has made that very clear. It's not advisory. It's not a litmus test, as they said in their briefing papers and as they told Judge Silverman below. Once the determination is made that the evidentiary support here does not pass muster under applicable Texas substantive law, the court saying, how could they possibly get it come to Delaware and get a better shake than they would if they were in their home state and had filed these cases there, then that constitutes no evidence. And therefore, it is not helpful to the jury, it's not admissible, and it is not relevant under Daubert. So we get to the Texas substantive law through the relevance prong of Daubert. I might add, just like federal courts sitting in diversity, governed by Daubert, and applying Texas substantive law do, and we've cited a number of those opinions to this court, including notably the Wells opinion from the Fifth Circuit.
Mr. Dillard,
the same analysis. It may not be articulated exactly like the court did in the Wells
case. Mr. Dillard, I have problems with the invocation of the concept of relevance in this context. Reliability, I understand. That, I believed, is what the gatekeeping function was supposed to do, and that is determine the reliability of the evidence, whether it's reliable enough that a jury can consider it on the merits. But there, as far as relevance is concerned, there are basically two types of relevance. One is logical relevance, and I don't think anybody can argue that testifying witness in this case, if you accept her opinion, that it isn't logically relevant. And legal relevance, basically is just a catch-all concept that governs, situations like Rule 403, where the prejudice may outweigh the logical relevance. So I don't know how that concept fits in at all. It would appear to me that if her testimony is reliable, certainly it's relevant either way, but it may not be reliable. But because it doesn't meet some evidentiary standard under Texas substantive law, all of a sudden it becomes irrelevant. It just seems to be a distortion of the concept, and I think it lends itself to confusion, and I don't understand why it appeared in the opinion and why it's being argued here.
Well, Your Honor, certainly her opinions were not reliable under Texas law.
I understand that.
And we would submit under Daubert law independent of Texas law, but that's not the order. As such, it is no evidence under Texas law. The Havner opinion says that. The Pollack opinion says that.
Okay, that doesn't render the opinion irrelevant. It just renders it inadmissible.
Well, if it's inadmissible, Your Honor, how could it be relevant to any issue before a court or jury? If it's inadmissible, how could it be relevant?
We're almost at the point where its relevance is irrelevant.
Hypothetically, if the plaintiffs had found another expert who had exact studies on point and who was going to testify as to causation consistent with the Haver case and Texas law and all of that, your position is that it would be no error to exclude this because it doesn't touch on the reliability and relevance required under Daubert. This expert could not even be a backup expert in some sense to in helpful to the jury in some way.
Your Honor, if the expert is relying on the same science and the same evidence, the same outcome should prevail. And that was true here. There are four causation experts. Judge Silverman listened to one for 4 days, but there were four causation experts who've been excluded. And I noted in looking at a number of opinions from courts in this state where there were multiple experts. So one could say, well, there was backup there because it was more than one expert espousing that science and that point of view. I note, in particular, the AstraZeneca opinions that Judge Slights was involved in. So the answer, I believe, Your Honor, is it would be the same outcome if there's two experts or three, or in this case four, relying on the same science. And if the opinions are ultimately unreliable under Texas law, then, and I don't mean to be on a play of words, and I fully understand the court's comments, but that, I believe, in answer to your question, Your Honor, is what Judge Silverman was saying and is saying, and it is very similar to what
I understand that's what he was saying. I just don't understand why he was saying it.
Understand, Your Honor.
Is it agreed between the parties that if Texas law applies, the testimony is insufficient and would be deemed unreliable under Texas law, or is there a dispute about that?
That is certainly our belief, and obviously. And is there a dispute between the parties? I think counsel has already said that he believes that his expert's testimony passed muster under Texas law. We don't think it was even a close call. But so there, in that sense, there is apparently a dispute.
Now, trial judge's citing of the legal sufficiency under Texas law for epidemiology studies, he suggested that was dicta, that that's not established Texas law. Is that right or wrong in your view?
That's absolutely incorrect, Your Honor. And the Garza opinion of the Texas Supreme Court and many other opinions make that abundantly clear. It is not dicta. It is, as Judge Silverman said, he referred to it as a more rigid set of standards for sufficiency of the evidence to satisfy the essential element of causation. It is not dicta.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
May I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes.
Your Honor, I'd like to speak with a couple of quick bullet points. I think of the essence, and each of Your Honors has touched upon this in your questioning, is the central notion of three concepts: reliability, relevance, and sufficiency. Let's talk about sufficiency for a moment. That shows up in a summary judgment motion. Imagine, Your Honors, that Judge Silverman said, I'm deeming under Delaware law, as I believe he should, that this is reliable. Epidemiology isn't even necessary in Delaware. I'm going to receive this evidence. But, of course, the defendants can move for summary judgment. They then move for summary judgment and say, Your Honor, Texas has, as they claim, this two epidemiological study standard, and the standards have to meet a bunch of criteria. And Dr. Frazier and her colleagues come up and say, we do meet those criteria. Here's why, A, B, C, and D. At that point, Judge Silverman has no latitude, having admitted the testimony, to say, this is for a jury to decide. Defendants have at her, persuade the jury, but I don't get to decide because I now have to draw every inference under the summary judgment standard in favor of the plaintiff. I have a witness who's telling me and is going to tell the jury that this passes Texas muster. End of story. And I hope that this crystallizes for the court the error that occurred below, because what Judge, your Honor, Justice Jacob, asked me a question about whether or not Judge Silverman could draw inferences. And I hope that this illustrates and assists, Your Honor, in at least seeing our point, which I don't think that he has that latitude.
Help me in this way. Let's assume hypothetical that Delaware enacts a statute that basically takes all of the Garza factors and the Texas law and makes it Delaware statutory law. Is your position that this testimony of this witness would still be admissible here?
Oh, absolutely. Because what Texas does, as do other states, it says, look, we don't need a single rigid study because in a civilized society you can't experiment on humans. So they will look at multiple studies and let you go from point to point. We didn't have two. We had 20 studies that each touched on an aspect. One talked about the industry. One talked about the chemical. One talked about the mix of chemicals. Others, when I say one, there's a whole chart, and we point to it in our brief, that touches on this. We believe that we cleared the Texas standard amply, and that, again, for Judge Silverman or any judge, again, on an uncontradicted record. My colleague says this is an immature tort. I've been doing these cases for 15 years in New York and elsewhere in the nation without any of these Daubert difficulties resolving them. If this was an immature tort and is so bizarre medically and scientifically, where was their expert? So I'd make that point. My colleague says that with respect to the Lynn study, we didn't quantify. He's simply mistaken. We submitted, and there was a big deal about this on the record, and it's in our brief, an affidavit from a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health who was involved in both the Lynn study and in the studies of the U.S. industry, including AMD, who told the court in sworn statement that they're the same, that the exposures are identical. They're doing the same thing, making the same product under rigorous standards. So, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. You're out of time, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.